Steve.
What's up, dude?
A Healthy Dose is a bi-weekly podcast hosted by Steve Krause, healthcare partner at Bessemer Venture Partners, and Trevor Price, CEO of Oxygen Partners.
Money talks, but it don't sing and dance and it don't walk.
The guys talk to leaders from various aspects of healthcare and cover personal stories, entrepreneurship, investing, and have a few laughs, many at each other's expense.
Well, we both enjoy the art of the conversation. We both have faces that are made for radio. So
at least eyebrows for me.
Double chin for me.
We get a lot of ones right, but we get a lot of ones wrong.
One of the most interesting conversations I've had in a long time.
If you pardon me, I'd like to say we do okay forever in blue jeans. Baby, tonight.
So some of the feedback we've got from folks who actually listen to us, and not just your mom and my mom, is that they love us to go deeper on subject matters that healthcare entrepreneurs deal with. And so we thought one of our first subject matter panels would be, how do you build great healthcare product and technology?
Yeah.
It's something that I know as an investor, I always think about. I know entrepreneurs are struggling. It's challenging. And we, I think, Trevor, are really lucky to get probably three of the leading doers and thinkers in the healthcare product and technology space. We had Jeremy Dolinsky, who was the very early chief technology officer at Athena Health, which is probably the most successful healthcare IT company out there.
Yeah.
Now is CTO of Wayfair, which is a consumer-focused, amazing company here in Boston. We had Julie Yu, who is the chief product officer of Kairos.
Yeah, I would love to embarrass her. I have a lot of conversations in healthcare, and whenever Kairos comes up, it is universal that the people who talk about Kairos talk just gushingly about Julie and her abilities and her creativity and the way that she has built the Kairos product. I mean, it is really remarkable.
Yeah, she's just a great product mind.
Yeah.
And then finally, Dave Hodgson, who now works with Trevor at Oxygen and is a great product innovator and has pretty much worked in every single subsector of healthcare building product, but probably most famously was the guy who built the technology and the product around One Medical.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fortunate enough to call him a friend and colleague. We work together on a daily basis. And it's just one of the really remarkable combinations of a great mind, a great heart, and then just absolutely tireless energy. I've been fortunate enough to get to know all three of these, and I know you have as well.
Yeah.
And they just exemplify so much of what I think gives me a lot of optimism about what we're doing in healthcare, which is, you know, these are people who are just fundamentally great people who are really committed to changing our healthcare system and are bringing just incredible intellect and incredibly creative approaches to doing that. And I think it really came across in this podcast.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of lessons learned here for folks who are building their companies and building healthcare product and technology, how to move quicker, you know, how to bring best practices from other industries into healthcare when it comes to technology, and then hopefully how to build happy product.
Yeah, I thought that was actually a really interesting framework, right?
Make our customers happy, which I think if people who used healthcare technology were happier, there'd probably be even better outcomes.
Yeah, I think when we started the Healthy Dose podcast, we've had a lot of these already, but this one definitely exemplifies the type of discussion I was hoping we would be having for these. So I hope the listeners will really enjoy this one.
All right, so we are pleased to have Jeremy Dolinsky, Julie Yu, and Dave Hodgson here for our first really deep subject matter podcast. I think we actually crowdsourced some questions for today's podcast. And so the first one I'd like to start with comes from Erica Morgenstern of WellTalk, who asked, how do you define great product?
Lots of different ways, but I guess what I would start with, you know, you got to have some level of market success, right? So if you go to Hims, if you kind of spend time in the startup communities in any city, you have a lot of people who like to talk about their products. But if people aren't using it and don't value it, then to me that, you know, so the most successful products are ones that people use, right? And I think maybe that if you kind of orient your product building organization, your engineers, certainly your product managers, toward solving a business problem that someone needs done in the world on their behalf, that's how you get users who are loyal.
But how do you know that early on? I mean, because you don't have usage early on. Like, how can you figure that out if you're in the trenches trying to build great products?
So I think that that is probably one of the things that leads the most businesses to fail, is the failure to achieve liftoff with any degree of engagement with users. And I think that, you know, that to me is among the hardest things starting an enterprise software company, is how do you get through the credibility sort of vacuum to a paying customer who is going to take a leap with you. We were just talking about that before this started with Julie about big organizations expect there to be a certain amount of credibility that you can provide for them before they even let you in.
Yeah.
And so you need to sort of pull out all the stops. I think Athena benefited from Jonathan Bush's charisma and Todd Park's charisma to get people to believe in them, that they, like, let us try. And once you get there, you know, the feedback cycles, I think, matter the most. There are so many times in my career where I thought something was going to be great, like a feature, a new design, and then you launch it and it flops. And the speed at which you get that feedback and you rework it and you relaunch it, to me, that's the whole business. How quickly can you iterate in front of people who are using your product?
And then there's an evolution from value proposition to uptake, to people actually using it. So I was wondering if you guys have insight in terms of, you know, how as product leaders or technology leaders, do you actually steer that? And how do you build an organization that can quickly respond to it?
We use three frameworks that get exactly to that value proposition. And on the question of what is make product success, you can use these to blend those two questions really rather well. The first one is really that all product strategies have to understand what the business objectives themselves actually are. And if they're poorly articulated, you can't have a great product. There's no way to do it. Or you can make a beautiful thing, but it won't move the business forward. So the first framework is exactly what are the business objectives as expressed as a value proposition, but often then translated backwards into very classic things about user acquisition, retention, or scaling, or what have you. The next framework is who are your users, what do they want, and where are they? And what they want is what's jobs to be done. What are they hiring, quote-unquote, your product to do, very Clayton Christensen style. So if you know what the business objectives of your business are, sometimes hard and not always clearly articulated value prop, you know who those target users are, where they live, meaning how you're going to market them and reach them, and the jobs to be done, then you can go really into product design. And we use over and over and over again a framework called the HEART framework, which was invented at Google. We used a lot when we started doing Google Design Sprints. And this is where you use a set of metrics to evaluate the performance of the product, exactly to your question. And the HEART framework is five different metrics, which is your product optimized for happiness, for engagement, for adoption, for retention, or task success? I'll give you an example. So Snapchat is entirely around happiness, comma, task success. Mostly happiness. It has no other real purpose in life.
What's task success there? Just sending a snap and getting it deleted.
It should be very quick for me to open the app, get a picture taken, and do what I want with it and go.
So I will tell you that Snapchat's task success is that 48-year-olds like me, whose kids are using it, cannot figure out how to use it. And that is incredibly,
it's a digital
device. Successful.
It's exclusivity.
It drives me nuts.
A lot of healthcare apps are really task success first.
Around,
can I make an appointment?
That's a great point.
Can I find the right provider and so forth? And then their secondary metric is adoption of that, and then ultimately retention of that.
Are those five equal, or is it in that order?
They're
is
not
it happiness
ranking,
all the way to task
You just
system?
Need to choose which ones are most important to your product and look for the metrics in each of them. So you might say, my new product, its metric is adoption. So I'm just looking at new users, bounce rate, things like this. Or maybe I have a product established. I want to have retention. So I want to look at how many hours are spent in it, how many times per day is it used, and so forth. And these are metrics that you can objectively evaluate your product rather than it's pretty, it's like it, you know, Fred loves it, it won a design award. This is just more objective.
Oh, I was going to ask you, before you ask the question, I was going to say, is there enough happiness in healthcare? Because it's interesting, you know, Athena is great at task and it's more enterprise, but is there enough happiness in healthcare? Because people want to use Snap, they want to use Facebook, right? They want to use Tinder.
Beautifully rhetorical question, because the answer is obviously no.
That's what I'm good at, rhetorical questions.
Because everyone is obsessed with the technology innovations in healthcare and how to innovate in AI or deep learning or analytics or what have you. But healthcare is human, and ultimately every product experience, be it a phone call or a piece of software, is operated by a human. And so the human centricity of healthcare is really kind of woefully behind. And if you really want to drive product metrics like adoption or retention or even task success, you have to bring the humanity back into it, which is that kind of second framework around who are these people, what do they care about, what is their level of competency with an app, what are they thinking about when they first open it, and those are all user-centric approaches rather than, I know my app needs to have a list of doctors, which is easy. Mm-hmm. And healthcare is really poorly infused with that, but thankfully, as we go to conferences, we talk to different companies, they want that now. The gap is simply the how, and finding people that know how to practice that and still know what healthcare means.
The only thing, I think it might depend on who you're building for. So, like, if you're building for doctors and other caregivers, and that technology generally is around helping them get through something they have to do for a patient, like ordering something or going through an exam, or identifying a patient who might need some help from them. So, you know, that's, call that population health, right? Someone who needs to have some kind of follow-up care, either for purposes of a contract or just purposes of conscience or the spirit of caregiving. I don't know that the technology itself necessarily needs to demonstrate heart so much as it has to enable the caregiver to, right? So how can you enable them to be practicing the way they want to? And that's a really hard technology problem. So I don't know that it's about the cuteness of the interaction so much as it is about understanding what you're building for that user.
The brilliance of Athena, the doctors were happy because they got paid by using their technology, right?
Exactly.
And so that was the happiness moment for them, I assume.
Right. Right. Yeah.
We've asked this on a couple of podcasts now. To me, there's a psychology of delay the inevitable with Americans and their healthcare, which is that, you know, there's a reason why so many people are type 2 diabetics in this country, when in reality, that's a solvable problem. You just have to have the will. I mean, there are many reasons, but you have to monitor and change your behavior. How frustrating is it to be the head of product and be trying to drive behavior change in your product in an industry that has shown a remarkable inability to change behavior?
Yeah. I mean, I think consumers is one thing. I think to Jeremy's point, it depends on who you're targeting. I think you could make that same blanket statement about providers. I mean, we serve schedulers in a call center, which is a completely different type of persona versus a consumer. I do think on a macro level, what you said about Americans and the culture of healthcare in this country, in some ways, if you take that as a given, I think you can take, you know, one approach to product versus saying, I must change the way that people behave and therefore have a different sort of hill to climb.
Elaborate on that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, for instance, our product, we don't consider ourselves a kind of a proactive population health management type play where we are trying to get people to do things that they're not otherwise going to do. Rather, we say when the patient has intent, try to maximize the yield from that particular encounter, right? So when I'm booking a PCP appointment, a super basic thing, I might only be thinking about the PCP appointment, but because I'm engaging with the health system around that single transaction, our system is trying to maximize, okay, what else can I get this person to do right when they're booking the appointment? So kind of contrite example is I'm a mom. Julie is likely to have a son who may also be a patient of my health system. While she's booking her appointment, can I cross-sell her on getting something done for her son or for her husband?
I thought, just back to the point about patients, I think for a second, and behavior change, I thought that was a very interesting question. And I think that, I guess now that I've been working in a consumer business, it's striking me how many developer releases have gone into figuring out how to match someone to an item in a product catalog or to get someone to click on a digital ad. Like, if you count the sort of amount of R&D hours that have gone into the consumer technology world, I think to say that it dwarfs the number of hours that have gone into building consumer engagement technologies in healthcare, I think would be understating it. I think it's like so radically off that I don't even think it's like a fair statement to say in the world that we've actually ever tried to engage patients through technology.
Just saying that we're spending such little time on actually, you know, user-driven design, essentially, consumer-driven design, to be fair.
I don't even, you know, what web products would you use as a patient today? Like, so you find some information out about a loved one or yourself, and you can go to patients like me, or you do research, and you kind of go to those kind of knowledge-type sites. Maybe you're going to go to your health system's website to like schedule something. Probably not going there to get
very
a lot of support. Like maybe you wear a Fitbit. Maybe you've launched, you know, health on your iPhone once. But like, what else is there?
Yeah.
Like there isn't this accumulation of learning in the world that somehow like we should be benefiting
from.
Well,
that makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, if you think about it, at Wayfair, your consumer is buying your product, right? I mean, that is the and in healthcare, up until really recently, when consumers had to bear more of the load, it's been, the consumer hasn't been the actual economic buyer, right? So it's not surprisingly that we haven't spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, consumer-driven design.
Is right. So ultimately, patients have to change their behavior, certainly around some of the chronic conditions.
That's right.
Like, there's a limit to what your doctor can do for you
if
you have no fundamental drive to own your health outcome,
right?
And it seems like we're at the early, early days of figuring out how to leverage technology to solve some of those problems.
I talked to you right after you left Athena.
Yeah.
And we had a conversation, and you indicated in the conversation that over the course of your career, you absolutely intended at some point in time, I hope I'm not getting you in trouble with your bosses, that you at some point in time would hope to come back to healthcare, and that one of the things you were trying to accomplish in going to Wayfair was to learn techniques that come from outside of healthcare around tech scale engagement, engaging consumers, and bring it back. Can you share some of your learning so far?
Yeah.
I mean, you've just talked, obviously, about split A-B testing.
Yeah, sure. So I guess a few things. So one thing that I've really come to appreciate is this idea that speed is, in fact, the only business, right? So, you know, e-commerce is perhaps the most bare-knuckled, market-driven business sort of out there, right? Like, there's no contracted revenue. Like, cash register starts at zero every day. Got to earn it every single day. And as a result, you know, you either innovate or you die. It's that simple. Like, there's a long body count of failed, certainly, e-commerce companies. Yeah. And, you know, we think we've carved a niche and we're, you know, up against a Goliath in the form of Amazon, and we love our chances. But when you're oriented around speed and you're oriented around the idea that you could die very quickly if your business isn't managed well, you try lots of things all at once and you care a lot less about making a mistake. So at Athena, I'd like to think that we are among the fastest health IT vendors out there working in the revenue cycle in EHR space, and that we were doing a client-facing release every month. That's 12 a year. Salesforce.com does 3. You know, most enterprise SaaS companies aren't doing releases every month. At Wayfair, we do a release every hour in the hour, 5 days a week from 8 a.m. till 5, 5 o'clock. And we managed not to take the site down. And we managed to, you know, as a result, I think, build things very quickly, get feedback on them very quickly. And when we do a test, it's not, let's just do a very simple A-B. It's like, there might be 5 variations of this test. It's very scientific about, you know, how many users you need to expose this to. You have to track them across different devices. I mean, it is a scale at which I don't think anyone in healthcare is doing any degree of testing today.
So I did the flip of what Jeremy has done, which is I came from e-commerce into healthcare, and I would say certainly all the same learnings just from a pure, like, development methodology perspective. I think the couple fundamental differences in terms of the nature of consumers in healthcare, I mean, when I think about, again, scheduling, just because that's my world, first of all, the percentage of scheduling activity that happens that's purely self-service consumer-driven is still less than 1%, right? So the vast majority of scheduling and referral activity still happens through call centers, through doctors, through, you know, trained professionals. And so as much as you want to move the needle on the business principles that our business is built on, you're not going to do that just by engaging consumers, let alone for the vast majority of consumers, we're not e-commerce shoppers. We don't go to a website every once a month or even once a year, you know, to do something with the health system. Like, I'm a pretty healthy individual. The last time I really engaged with the health system was when my child was born. And since then, I've really not done anything else. And so the concept of somebody being the principal agent of making a decision that results in a transaction at the scale and at the velocity that a Wayfair deals with, it just doesn't exist.
But,
right?
But let me push you, because you had a child, and your interactions with the healthcare system may not be you, but they're now the pediatrician and the other services that your child's taking. So has the hospital that you delivered at been able to actually use technology and engagement to keep you close into their physician network? And into, are they able to engage you on kind of just top of mind in terms of their brand?
Like, customer lifetime value, right?
Yeah,
like, the best practice would say to retarget you, right, from the internet.
Yeah, no,
doesn't
they
happen.
Haven't.
We were just looking at the lifetime customer value of a new mom, if you actually turn them into a promoter for your system, is $1.5 million.
A plug for Dosen Health, by the way.
and that's the opportunity. I think it's been completely untapped.
There's two big lagging reasons. Is one is the economics have not been super clear because of how patients acquire care. So there hasn't been that direct-to-consumer equation from the accounting level, although that's changing. The second one is really the know-how to do rapid deployments and rapid split testing and other kinds of consumer-level techniques. And they're not directly liftable. So there's a certain rule set and regulatory set you have to play with. And so what I've always found very interesting is hiring product managers from a consumer world and then trying to teach them healthcare, or the other way around. People who really understood healthcare, knew what the rules were, but getting them to move faster and innovate. Where you can split test, but you have to have someone with a control point saying, well, that's actually inappropriate.
Yeah.
You can't actually say
that.
The
stakes are high for getting it wrong.
Yeah, you have to make sure that both of those things are balanced appropriately. And that's where it gets super, super interesting. I think healthcare, the economics have to move it first, and then the knowledge of how to actually execute it with all of those constraints have to come right after it.
And I think the version of that for the non-consumer users, like the majority of our users are not consumers. And so we also try to do very rapid release cycles early on. I'm sure you heard this at Athena. Mm-hmm. Our users complained that we were evolving our product too quickly because we were part of a mission-critical workflow. Mm-hmm. If they had to learn a new thing every day, that is extremely burdensome.
Disruptive,
mentally.
Yeah.
It's sure. Something that...
But I think that even if, let's say, take consumers back out for a second, mm-hmm. and let's say you're building a healthcare IT product for enterprise software product that the users are going to be, you know, physicians or people who are paid effectively. It's their job to use the system. I think that there is this tremendous fear, exactly what you said, which is that people get angry when you move their cheese.
Yeah.
And if you are in the business of selling technology, you have a customer service organization that starts to channel that feedback, mm-hmm. like back into the organization. And as a result, I think there's a little bit of this fear of like, well, what's, you know, a bug is very serious. And mm-hmm. sometimes it is quite serious. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the magnitude of the problems in healthcare and how early we are into solving some of them, the answer has to be release more often, get more chances to solve the problem, because it's really only through iteration that we get better. And I think that is the nut to solve, is like, how do you create a zone where product managers, designers, and engineers in your organization can release as often as they need to get mm-hmm. insight
yeah,
into whether
the
they're solving
any
problems or not. Great people don't love working in slow places.
Yeah. Right. But I think the industry certainly has gotten much better, I would say.
Yeah.
I mean, since 6 years ago when Kairos launched, we were still educating people about what cloud-based solutions were. And I think Athena did a huge job educating the market about that, to one in which people said, okay, fine, cloud, but the concept of me getting the same release as thousands of other users at the same time, you know, need to get used to that, to now where we are doing monthly releases just like Athena does. And that is a huge, you know, step change relative to where I think the industry was several years ago.
You know, I think we all have this sense, and we're talking about, is that healthcare is slow and behind the times, right? And I remember when I started working in healthcare IT, you know, a decade and a half ago, I mean, it was literally green screen technology almost, right? So if you were the chief technology czar of the country and could change one thing that would allow healthcare to speed up, what would it be? You want two things.
I have two things.
Okay.
I don't think you get the meaningful kind of speed or innovation until two things are true. One is that the majority of reimbursement and revenue is value-based. It needs to be 60 to 80% of revenue. It needs to be value-based, not fee-for-service-based. So it really is incentivized around higher quality at lower cost. That's one. And then secondly, is my other, maybe it's a secondary thing, which is there needs to be, just which is a part of meaningful use three, is there needs to be a public API for all major EHR and practice management systems so that the data is free as well.
So it's, everything's open-walled, open-garden.
Right. So if you get paid for that and you can get at the data, now we'll innovate at kind of internet speed.
I don't know. I think I buy the first part. I think that, yeah, clearly there's no motivation like working for your paycheck, right? Like, I think not only will health systems and physicians invest, but there'll be a market that follows them to help them navigate what that new reality is for them. I think that that's very true. I kind of feel like we're also, like, I was sort of inspired by the language of the cancer moonshot, mm-hmm. because what that implies to me is a realization that people simply don't know the answers to lots of these questions, right? So moonshot implies an incredibly difficult mission where you have to inspire the greatest of a generation to think about solving those problems. And I think that that doesn't really match, to me, the mindset that has, you know, sort of embodied in things like meaningful use, which is sort of like a very prescriptive set of actions and measures that presume that if you comply with those, healthcare will be better. And I don't think we necessarily know what will make healthcare better, but certainly a lot of hours and money has gone into building compliance features and functions for meaningful use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't know that we're any better off.
Let's actually talk about that, because I think we hear a lot of people talk about the first generation of the EMR is capturing all the data, but there isn't a lot of value that's added to that process. It's capturing the data. Frankly, I think it's helping organizations bill, become more efficient at billing. The EMR 2.0, does it happen? When does it happen? What does it consist of? credit where credit's due, Dallin Allred asked that question through our crowdsourcing.
Co-founder of Artemis Health.
Yeah. Any best of breed solution that sits atop an EHR is trying to solve a problem that the EHR doesn't do very well. And so in some ways, it's less about EMR in its current form being reinvented, but more what are the pieces of the EMR that can be innovated on through point solutions that over time can grow in their footprint.
Let's push on that for a second. Epic, Cerner have obviously the two largest market shares. Neither one of those companies is particularly acquisitive, mm-hmm. right? You have CIO organizations and hospital systems that are out 2 years to 3 years to evaluate a new technology implementation. So if you have these small point products that are being built on top of the EHR, the EMR to add value, and the technology organization can't actually sustain it. And in Epic's situation, they haven't even been particularly mm-hmm. you know, open in terms of data.
Yep.
And neither one of those is particularly acquisitive, which would then accelerate the sales cycle. If they were mm-hmm. buying these, they could put them into the systems to actually deliver value. How do you get around that?
Yeah, I hope to see some of that change. Like, I think those companies are, I don't know if you guys are listening to like the Cerner reports that are coming out. I mean, they're clearly recognizing that they yeah. need to fundamentally think about the world differently. And you see it coming out in their marketing and all of that too. So I think one is we all hope that that behavior will change. I see a lot of analogies thinking back to my days at Endeca to like the SAPs of the world and the Oracles
of
the world, that yeah, exactly. they were the ERP systems. They were greatly designed to collect massive amounts of data. But as soon as you need to do something with that data, there was a whole ecosystem of other stuff that kind of occurred around it.
Yep.
Yeah, and then you had single companies that became clear leaders in those segments, like Salesforce, like yeah. others. And
that's
so,
why I say the forcing of an API is one way to do it.
Yeah.
But ultimately, when an EHR is not a vertically integrated thing mm-hmm. as much as it's this enabling
yeah, platform
with an ecosystem. And Cerner talks a good game and Athena talk a good game. I'd like to see where the economics really make that
yeah.
a competitive advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So you now have an ecosystem of third parties and we can point to lots of other examples. I think that's my big, big hope. My big, big fear is that the cost of switching. Once you learn Epic, just as I was saying earlier, once all of your staff is on Epic, your whole system's on Epic, the switching cost is so enormous and the momentum of that is so enormous that even if there was a really compelling option, maybe Athena is, maybe others are, that the switching cost is so high you don't really get past it.
Yeah.
I would see this playing out in, I believe that, you know, Google G Suite is better than Microsoft 365, but people are so used to bloody Word and PowerPoint
yep.
mm-hmm. that they don't switch. Why would they want to learn anything else?
Why are you looking
even if
at
it's
me
better? I don't know. I don't know. Why would I look at you, Trevor? But that switching cost
David's
is not...
forced me to do the G Suite conversion over the last couple of weeks.
I just switched over to Google. It's painful. People are like, don't take bloody Excel out of my hands. And that's almost a semi-trivial example. But in EHR, it's pretty serious
yeah,
amount of productivity.
It's very serious.
To make a value prop to change that. And any system that's going through a change right now, we've talked to a few of them, it's enormous.
It's interesting. I think what you're getting out of this conversation is almost like why the EHR market, it's produced a lot of billionaires. Like, it's a good business if you can get it. If you can be one of the ones that gets traction, like, you can make some serious
Judy
money.
Judy Faulkner has a good business.
Yes. And so, you know, I guess what I would say is, like, I get nervous when I hear, like, well, if only the government would mandate, like, open APIs. Because in fact, like, I wonder whether people are just shying away from giving it a shot, right? Because I think what I started to see in my kind of last days in the health IT market was obviously the current generation of EHRs weren't helping people in a value-based world. So what all these big vendors were doing was building another platform, and that was maybe their on-road to the cloud, like I think that's what Cerner was doing, for instance, where you'd build like an analytics tool that would be your population health and value-based care solution, and that would somehow keep alive your aged EHR that wasn't really connected to that. I think Athena is trying to actually have the EHR evolve very much into a population-based health platform. But I think that, you know, when I think about this, like, I wonder whether there are going to be more entrants. You know, clearly Salesforce is interested in healthcare.
Yes.
Clearly Google's interested in healthcare. Clearly Apple's interested in healthcare. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if someone else just looks at this and says, wait a minute, these vendors all stink. I can spend $500 million in R&D to build something that I think would work.
Let's stay there for a second, because I mean, this is a theme that's gone through a lot of our podcasts. And, you know, it feels like when that happens, when those traditional tech players come into healthcare,
yeah.
it's a tipping point. Why would they do it now? It's been talked about for a while. Why now?
I don't think it's any less of a market opportunity than it was, you know, back in the day. Like, if you believe that all the established vendors have an inside line towards solving these problems, have built a great product, almost coming back to where we started this conversation, if you believe that this is sort of solved space, Yeah, why would you?
I think your point is similar to mine about, I'm saying about government mandate of an API.
Yep.
I think it's not too dissimilar from the big tech giants will save us. And I think it's too hard, and I don't think they'll do it. And yeah. I think what we've seen from Google in the past, what we've
You're
seen
skeptical,
from Apple,
babe.
Oh, yes, awfully. And, you know, I've talked to Clarence many times at Salesforce, and Godspeed, I hope you do something. But yeah. it's super bloody hard. You know, I've built some of these enterprise systems from scratch. It takes a lot of work. I would rather see the more kind of flat iron model, where we start to see an oncology-based EHR, or a little kind of small ecosystem. I'd like to have that on some kind of dreamy open standard or open API kind of ecosystem, a la platforms, but there'd be plenty of kind of point solutions. I'd love to see that iteration first, because I just couldn't see the big tech elephants really
I think I was using them more as a sort of the idea that smart business people will look at this market and say there's still opportunity.
Yeah.
And yes, I think we've lots of failed sort of forays into healthcare from people who don't get it fundamentally.
Yeah.
But I think that there's still room for new entrants.
Right, and I think the why now is it is the post-EHR era. Like, that was one of the big themes that I think we all heard at HIMSS was everyone has spent their $1 billion on Epic or Cerner or whatever it is. The dust has settled, and there are still gaps, right? So
yes.
I think, to your point, anyone looking at that says there's still opportunity on the table. I would agree that I'm skeptical that other outside firms, like the ones that we're mentioning, are going to be the ones who necessarily win it in the near term. But I think it's a signal. To me, them coming into this market is more a signal of the fact that those gaps need to be filled and the opportunity is happening now.
By the way, you point out that it's the business folks who might come in and recognize the opportunity who have tech background. I mean, Nat at Flatiron started a company they sold to Google. He was a tech guy before he was a healthcare guy. On that note, I mean, you know, when we all were in this industry 15 years ago, it was a bunch of gray-haired, you know, healthcare folks designing technology. And now it feels like Silicon Valley has woken up to say, oh my God, there's this huge opportunity that you point out, Jeremy. Let's every tech person come in and try to start a new company. Has this been a good thing?
Have you seen the product
improve?
Yes, but I still worry a lot about some of the scandalous and kind of naive attempts that generate a lot of funding. You know, big tech person for who is X name big, large tech company is going to come and solve all the problems. I think net, it's definitely an improvement, but again, I think there's an array of small innovations, not one big kind of fanfarous type of thing that we like, that's very pressable, and what's the Uber for healthcare going to look like? And we've seen some of those, everything from Castlight to Theranos. I think we need less of those, and we need more of kind of the little guys, and to get a full ecosystem of that. But Silicon Valley being interested from a business point of view and from an innovation point of view, absolutely.
I think that the chemistry behind high growth, branded, non-tech entrepreneur who, after making tons of money doing what they're doing now, wants to become mission-driven and moves into healthcare, is, on the face value of that, is a wonderful thing for our industry. And I think it is going to elevate the game around quality of product and creativity of thinking. What's happening, though, is that little definition applied to 18% of GDP and $4 trillion of problems to solve is creating unrealistic expectations for many of these companies from a valuation standpoint and from a growth standpoint. Additionally, and I don't want to be the healthcare guy who says, this is really complex. We have government regulations. We have HIPAA. We have all these things. But we do.
Yeah.
And so the challenge is what I don't want to have happen is that this collective ecosystem of really smart, successful, non-healthcare entrepreneurs and tech and product people coming in, investors funding them, both of them becoming frustrated because the growth rates aren't as quick, the valuations aren't achieved, and then everyone's saying, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
I'm super optimistic that if everyone has patience, what concerns me is when we see these valuations and we see these expectations for companies that are just fundamentally not reasonable. When you start to look at the dynamics, if you've had enterprise sales cycles at Kairos, right? That is not easy to navigate.
Absolutely. And in some ways, I don't think it's unique to healthcare. Like, at the most abstract level, what we're talking about
is
domain expertise is necessary to be successful in any business. And I think part of, you know, frankly, what we see on the street is the tech folks come in and it's more of an attitude thing where you say tech can solve everything and not actually appreciate the nuance of what it means to deliver care to a patient or what it means to deal with HIPAA, things of that sort.
Yeah, so I think I laugh whenever I hear people talk about healthcare IT things that could somehow be viral. Like, there's nothing viral about healthcare IT, no pun intended. Like you know, it's a slog, right? Like, you know, you can't just build a beautiful little app and somehow, you know, you're going to... I don't think there's going to be a healthcare equivalent
of Snap. I always say
you
can't hyperscale healthcare.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And so I think that it takes a long time to build these businesses that make a difference, right? And to go through the enterprise sales cycle. So I think it's, well, I'd want to adopt some of the technology advantages of consumer businesses around sort of speed of innovation. I think the expectations are that this is looks more like the life cycle of enterprise technology companies, which are different. Like, you don't just blast onto the scene overnight.
I'd be remiss. We're in a room with, honestly, three of the best product tech minds in our industry. I think for our listeners, I'd love to share some lessons learned. So let's start off with a negative question. What was your biggest product slash tech failure? And what did you learn from it that you'd share?
I think ours was trying to integrate too quickly. So
integrate with
the existing ecosystem of tech, namely EHRs and practice management systems. But part of what we've now reverted to is, if your standalone thing can't drive value in and of itself in the absence of any integration, then question it. I think in our initial thesis and design of our product relied on integration with scheduling systems. What we found, that was just too hard. I mean, 6 years ago, there was no notion of a real manifestation of interoperability. I think we're still challenged by that today in many ways, but because we relied on that, we failed because we just couldn't deploy the product at scale or anywhere close to scale. When we then rolled that back and said, okay, what is the essence of our core product that in the absence of scheduling, we can, you know, drive value with? That actually became the crux of our product platform as it stands today. And then interoperability becomes an add-on where you can drive additional value, but it's not the dependency. So early on, we learned that the hard way.
So build a product that in and of itself delivers value without
that's right.
any other...
Unless there happens to be an area of interoperability, quote unquote, that is very liquid today. And I think those are probably very few and far between in healthcare.
Dave?
The most kind of arrogant failure I ever did was laboring for a year on a telehealth platform, which was the idea that you would sign up to this platform as to find out how healthy or well you would be, you would get a lab test and you'd be on a phone with a physician to explain the lab test. And it was a great kind of product and people who went through it enjoyed it and clinically it was all solid, but we couldn't market it or get the acquisition that we really wanted out of it. And the hard lesson over many months of doing SEM and social media and everything else is just the hard lesson, which was back in 2012, that patients fundamentally don't see care coming from an internet app or from a little startup. They wake up in the morning, they feel sick, and they call their doctor that lives in an office in a place with an appointment card and all that very traditional accoutrement of going to a patriarchal care provider. And that model, even though internet blah, 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 is still kind of fairly present today. And so the kind of a brutal realization that virtual care, even though you can prosecute it clinically really well, patient experience is really great, people still aren't there in how they think about care. And so hard lesson learned in how virtual care is delivered. A little standalone startup can't do it. And that has led to now you see lots of models where folks like MDLive and others are folding underneath classic brands. So they're the power underneath Cedar Sinai or Centura Health. And the models will open up from traditional ones rather than a standalone startup with a very particular sexy idea saying, hey, get your care this way.
I think that looking back on my time at Athena, the thing that I probably regret the most was being comfortable with the speed at which we were releasing. So I think I felt very, very good about myself that our team was doing a monthly release. And I think that I stopped figuring out how to make that team faster. I felt like that speed was good enough and it was all about how do I get more people on this team.
We need you back in healthcare. We need you to move faster.
That's the thing. I think that if Athena could be sort of off of this language of sort of like versioned releases. Like, we don't have versioned releases at Wayfair. Like, right. Amazon doesn't have versioned releases.
Right, right.
Getting out of that paradigm and more into functionality goes out the door when it's ready and you turn it on for clients and some agreed upon cadence. I don't feel like we got that entirely right. And I certainly didn't as the technology leader of that team.
One other sharing lessons question. Can't name your product that you built. What is your favorite product? And what lesson would you take from it that you apply to healthcare if you could?
Dave, don't say Tinder.
Don't say Snapchat.
You know, this is a really hard question. I wish you'd given us prep time. My favorite product, and Trevor will still roll his eyes, is not a piece of software, but it's an experience. My favorite product, as you know, is CrossFit. And the reason I like CrossFit...
CrossFit.
Yes, yeah, CrossFit, okay. The fitness regime slash cult. The reason I like CrossFit and I use this when we talk about people who are diabetic and need to get into a program, or people who even are cancer survivors and need to be in a program, CrossFit's a great example of you go there for one reason and you stay for another. You go because you want to get fit, because you want to lose some pounds or you want to get stronger. You actually don't stay for those things, even though you will accomplish them. You stay because you make friends and you have a routine and you enjoy the social aspect of being in a class with some intensity with people who are like you.
You wouldn't tell from my physique because it's not as good as yours, Dave, but I also do CrossFit. And the thing that I think is also interesting is they really introduced gaming mechanics too. And not in a way that's in your face, actually, in a way that is totally subconscious.
Yeah. Appointment dynamic. Yeah. Challenges, there are newbies, there are experts, and the experts help the newbies. So there's a whole structure there that it feels great to you. And again, you can't often see it.
Yeah.
And so I love using that example of when we had people who were high blood pressure and diabetic, we did a cooking class for them. So they went because they were diabetic or they were high blood pressure, but they stayed and kept going because they made friends. And they kept going because they made friends. Those intrinsic motivations are the one that drive people, apropos, you know, Snapchat. Not the extrinsic ones of my blood pressure and my A1C.
What about you guys?
I would say, so Amazon, so one of my...
You took mine.
We'll both answer then. So it was funny, one of the candidates I was interviewing recently said, can you tell me who your favorite superhero is and why? And I said, my superhero is Jeff Bezos, because I'm actually more fascinated by the business, I would say, and how the platform has enabled the business that they have today. If you had asked me, you know, 3 years ago, which company I thought had the best shot at going after Google or Apple, I would not have said Amazon, but now I absolutely do. And I think, it to me, it's the ubiquity, the way that they have completely eliminated friction for me to transact with their platform, whether it's on an app, whether it's through Alexa, whether it's even just the fact that my business runs on AWS, and therefore in the back of my mind, I associate Amazon with a certain level of reliance. And yeah, exactly. So I think that would be my answer, is the platform approach that they've taken.
Amazon, I also take, that was the company I was thinking about. And it was, while I love the user experience, so, you know, I'm a loyal Prime member, have been forever, and the number of Amazon packages that show up my door is sort of astonishing. But the takeaway for me about that business is just the boldness of thinking about what levers really are available to you. Mm-hmm. So Amazon is buying freaking planes because FedEx and UPS can't keep up with
them. They're opening bookstores again.
Right, right. Yeah. Just that nothing is off the table is so inspiring, right? And they've obviously built sort of this thing that could make those big capital spends when they needed to, and the business throws off so much cash that you can do it.
Yeah.
But I feel like so many technology conversations, certainly in healthcare IT, but in general, are fundamentally bounded by what could we do today with the resources I have, with the current state of technology.
Yeah, I agree. The Amazon, I mean, a longtime holder of that stock, because it's crazy, I think, where they came from and how now, I mean, almost every decision they make is a bold bet, but it's reinforcing of the enterprise,
totally.
Right?
Strategically, I mean, it all makes sense.
We need Amazon to come and help.
Actually, the tactical, the tactical thing I would say is the learning is the fact that the things that they know I do over and over again, they've made it such that it's one click.
Right.
I think that's the one thing, like just tactically.
Moving friction.
In healthcare, doctors and nurses and call center agents do the same thing every day 100 times, and yet they still have to go through the same exact workflow every single time. And I think that's just a product design learning.
Steve, I think when we started Healthy
Dose.
We could
go for this for hours,
right? When we started a Healthy Dose, this is what we had in mind.
Yeah, this is it. This
three friends, colleagues, you know, luminaries in the industry, shooting the shit about interesting stuff in healthcare. So, Jeremy, Julie, Dave, thank you so much from, I think, both of us for taking the time to spend with us today.
No pun intended, an epic podcast.
But
thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Let my travel be
forever in blue jeans. Thanks for listening to A Healthy Dose. Please subscribe through iTunes, and if you have any suggestions for topics or guests, email the guys at steve@bvp.com or trevor@oxyandpartners.com. We do okay.